Okay, you'll note in verses 4 and 5, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, the statement made by the Apostle Paul that every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonors his head. And every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, for that is one and the same as if her head were shaved. For if a woman is not covered, let her also be shorn. But if it is shameful for a woman to be shorn or shaved, let her be covered. Now, this passage is dealing with the subject of subjection and a practical application of that subject with regard to praying and prophesying. There are specific things that are mentioned there in verse 4 and 5 with regard to a man's practice in praying and prophesying and a woman's practice in praying and prophesying. Notice that the word prophesy is used in conjunction with the concept of praying. Prophecy is a spiritual gift. And in fact, the Apostle Paul, beginning, I suppose, in this particular text, and to a very great extent, though there are some interpolations throughout, but through the entirety of chapters 11, 12, 13, and 14, is dealing with the practice of spiritual gifts, the use of spiritual gifts, which the Corinthians had a real problem with in the first century. There were a lot of abuses with regard to the practice of spiritual gifts, a couple of which specifically involve women. It is found here in chapter 11 as well as in the 14th chapter with regard to the subject of prophecy. And we'll have opportunity as we continue our study to talk in more detail about chapter 14, 34, and following with regard to the woman in that situation. So that's at least the context of what is under consideration at this time. There seem to have been some violations with regard to proper conduct with regard to women in the Church of Corinth, and he was discussing that and explaining what was needed. Now, having said that, we acknowledge the statement in verse 5, every woman who prays and prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. And we recognize that there are some today in our day and time, in our culture, who feel conscience-bound, certainly, to wear a covering. Now, the covering may differ. For some, it may be a hat. Others, it may be a small shawl or a doily or some crocheted thing, some scarf to cover their head. The word, actually, just to make note of it, it is translated covering in the text and was commonly used with regard to this dress, is a Greek word which, if you define it, is an article of clothing that wraps around a person. And it is not specifically a word that is used just about a head covering, but a covering in general, a mantle, a cloak, or if it is concerning the head, then a veil, what we commonly refer to as a veil. So with regard to what was worn in the first century, it seems to be something that was more inclusive or encompassing of the head than even what you typically see worn by individuals in worship today. Just to make note of that, not to be dogmatic about it, except to make a point in this regard, is that the practice of wearing a veil, as it is practiced in the Lord's church today, is as a symbol. And I think that's right and proper. If you'll notice the statement in verse 10, for this reason, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. So it is a symbol. And it may be that some would feel that what it is that is less important, that something be on their head as a symbol of authority. A couple of things to note with regard to this is we acknowledge that not everyone does wear that covering. Not every woman. In fact, it is not the custom in our congregation It's not the most common thing to see a woman wearing a hat or a veil. So why is it, if we emphasize the need to have authority for our practices and to comport ourselves as God intended, why is it that women in our day and time do not feel it necessary to wear an artificial veil or covering on their head in the midst of worship? And so we sought to establish some principles in our discussion last week, and I hope to draw some conclusions with regard to that this week with regard to the practice. Two things to note. First of all, we're going to have to recap exactly the principles that we established from the scripture, from the text. Secondly, I do not want anyone who feels conscience bound to wear a covering, an artificial covering. Seeing that, as I alluded to last week, I do not believe it necessary for a woman in worship, in the assembly, to wear one. I do not want that to seem that I'm in any way ridiculing the position or am not aware of the dictates of conscience in this matter. If a woman feels, as a matter of conscience, that she must wear it, then she should, and nothing that is said today should be a discouragement or be considered a discouragement of that. Having said that, there are a couple of things that are established as principles that, if these principles are followed, recognized, and addressed, that an individual can worship God acceptably as a result of that. And we want to talk a little bit about what those principles are. First thing that we emphasized in our discussion last week is the headship of man. What the Apostle Paul is establishing in this text is the headship of man. The third through the tenth verses of the text emphasize this. The head of every man is Christ, the head of woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. And so this practice here with regard to prayer and prophecy, as a distinction is made between man and woman, the distinction is made because of the headship of man and the fact that the woman is in a position of submission, both in the home as well as in the church. Now, when you go to 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and you note the discussion of the woman's silence in the assembly, and again, the violation of that principle as it was being practiced in the church of Corinth, you will see the same arguments being made by the apostle concerning the headship of man and what should be submission on the part of a woman in the church, in the assembly, with regard to her keeping silence in the assembly. I do believe that, though we may make some more broad applications in regard to this, that what the Apostle Paul is discussing in this context are violations or abuses in the assembly with regard to prayer and prophecy. I do believe that what was under consideration are women who were taking part in it. Now, this is not what we might refer to as a... what's the term? It's not coming to me. Passive. Sometimes it comes if you work hard enough. So we're not talking about something in which the woman is passive or where she is actively taking part. In other words, not that she is listening to a prayer, but she is in actuality praying. Not where she is listening to prophecy, but rather she is actually prophesying in this particular context. And so with regard to that, there were abuses that were present. And it seems that the Apostle Paul is giving instruction in regard to that. Okay, so as a result of this contention that the man is head of the woman, there is this distinction that is made between men and women. Now, a couple of other things I want to go through very quickly, and then I'll open it up to any questions and comments that any might have. You'll notice in verses 5 and 6 of the text that if a woman is not sufficiently covered, that there is a cause for shame in this regard. And specifically in verses 5 and 6, he makes a distinction with regard to this. It is a dishonor for her. She is shaming herself, and it is as it would be if she were to be shorn or shaved. So this is talking about having the hair shorn, which would be cut very short, or shaved, which would mean a woman would have her hair completely removed. This was, in this particular culture, something that was considered shameful. We mentioned that it was typically either a sign of mourning, where individuals would do this as a sign of their distress, or it was something that was done by someone who was common. In fact, it was the practice of a consort or prostitute not shave, but cut their hair very short as a symbol of who it was that she was. So it was something that was tied closely with shame in their culture. And so he uses that as an argument with regard to her humiliation in engaging in activities that were inappropriate without that symbol. Now, what I did not have an opportunity to discuss in detail is verse 10 of the text. And I do want to make note of this, because I think it again ties in with the practice that is mentioned in verses 4 and 5. In verse 10, it is as a result of this relative place that the woman holds, a place of subjection, this place of submission, that the Apostle Paul says, this is the reason that the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head. Now again, this is in the case of her praying and prophesying, that in this time, when she is doing this, she ought to have a symbol of authority on her head. Now, this is typically translated, or at least interpreted, as indicating that this veil or this covering is a symbol of her submission. That she is showing individuals that she is in submission when she wears this veil. That's actually not what the text teaches. The term authority in this particular context is the same one that we've seen time and again. The term exousia, and it is indicative of the authority or the right to do or engage in a particular activity. So what this is, this covering, is an indication of her right or her authority to engage in the activity that she is engaging in. The symbol of authority is not a symbol of submission, but an indication, a recognition on her part that in doing this, she certainly is submissive, but that she is indeed engaging in an activity that is authorized by God. The cause of this, the idea that the symbol, you know, she is in this place of submission. It is not typical for a woman, was not typical for a woman in the first century to take any type of leadership role, and yet she has received a spiritual gift, specifically talking about the gift of prophecy. And so she is to exercise this spiritual gift. So she has the right to exercise this spiritual gift, but at the same time, she is a woman. So that it is recognized that she is engaging in this activity with the approval of God. She puts the veil or the covering on her head as a symbol of that authority that she has to engage in that gift and the use of that gift that she has been given. So it's not an indication of submission, although it is to be done because she is submissive. But rather, in this particular case, the wearing of that is an indication that what she is doing is authorized by God. And again, the gift of prophecy is something that is given by the Spirit. It is something that can be controlled by individuals. That's something that people, I think, in our day and time do not recognize. Among the charismatics, speaking in tongues, for example, is seen to be a rather spontaneous action over which individuals have no control. Well, that's obviously not the case because the Apostle Paul is telling the Corinthians, telling the men, don't speak in tongues unless there's someone to interpret. Telling the women, don't speak in tongues at all in the assembly, 1 Corinthians chapter 14, and indicating that if you are going to engage in the use of a particular gift, that it is to be done with the covering or with the veil. So I think that there is a very clear indication from that that the veil is to be worn with regard to the positive or active participation in these particular actions as a sign or a symbol or a token of the subjection of the woman. Right, as she engages in that thing that she has the right to do. Okay, so keeping that in mind, a couple of other things to note, and then we'll talk about it. Verses 14 and 15, he makes an argument from nature, very similar to the idea of the headship of man. We talked a bit about what nature means and what the degree is in regard to it, but the argument is that nature teaches you a distinction between a man and a woman with regard to hair. And is something that we acknowledge and recognize. It's something that is obvious in our culture as well, because typically women have longer hair and have shorter hair. I risk the disapproval of some men in this congregation to say, normally women don't go bald. We have a few bald pates among the men in our congregation today. So we see and understand that there is a distinction and difference. So there's a principle that's in play here as well that we need to acknowledge, and that is that there is a difference between men and women, and that an attempt to muddy the waters, to alter that, to take on a persona that is not natural is something that is a shameful thing. It's something that's alluded to as an example in Romans, the first chapter, with regard to the with regard to homosexuality. One of the terms that that is used in the New Testament to refer to a homosexual man has an indication of effeminate behavior. Or demeanor or appearance, and we see that certainly as we look at that our society today, because homosexuality has had some influence in society, where you have men who act in very effeminate ways, and you have women who act in a very masculine way. It's including demeanor. It also is inclusive of dress. And here the Apostle Paul indicates that difference exists. It is something that is recognized and understood for individuals to try to, a woman to try to appear as a man, or a man to try to appear as a woman. That's something that is a shameful thing. And that's something that could be accomplished through the length of hair. Now, what problem is when you read verses 14 and 15 is how long is long and how short is short. I'm not going to go there. I don't know that I could, and I don't know that if I did, others would agree with the lines that I would draw in that regard. So I'm going to say this, and I think that it's something that we can certainly agree on, is if a man looks effeminate because of the length of his hair, and that, of course, is his desire to be more feminine looking and to blur those things, that's a shameful thing for him. He ought to be ashamed of himself to be that way. And if a woman is seeking to be masculine and she wears hair short in a style that makes her appear to be masculine, that's something that is shameful as well. Okay? So, one final point, and then we'll open it up. Verse 16. This ends this area of study. This is 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 16. This ends this particular thought, this particular paragraph with regard to the head covering. In verse 16 it says, if anyone seems to be contentious, we have no such custom, nor do the churches of God. I want you to notice that with regard to this practice of the head covering, that was a custom. That is specifically referred to as being a custom in the church in the first century. Now, to properly understand this text, he's basically saying, I've given you this explanation with regard to these things, but someone might want to argue with me about women not having to wear a covering, not having to wear a veil. And so his answer to the individual who might want to still argue is that there is no such custom of a woman praying and prophesying with her head uncovered in the church. That's the idea that is found here. The no such custom, it doesn't have anything to do with the no such custom of being contentious. The custom is the wearing of the veil. And so to say we have no such custom is an indication that it was typical practice in the first century for a woman when she is praying and prophesying for her to cover her head. And so the instructions here, basically, that the Apostle Paul is giving the church in Corinth is to follow the customs in the church. And that certainly was the custom in the first century. Now, when you talk about custom, then the principles that we discussed a little bit last week come into play with regard to what, at what point in time do customs change? Is it all right for Christians to alter their behavior and their demeanor in that regard? I'm going to give you just a couple of examples that we recognize and we commonly utilize, and then I will say that I believe this to be a parallel. The first one would be with regard to the washing of feet. It was custom in the first century to wash feet. Now, what was the washing of feet? What was the significance of the washing of feet in the first century? Well, first of all, feet were dirty. you had open shoes, sandals. You had unpaved streets. You had less hygienic circumstances in the first century. And so it was a custom for there to be provided when someone would come into your home, water and a towel or rag, so that an individual could wash their feet and clean their feet before they come into the home. Now, an individual who was showing hospitality and humility would wash the feet of their guests. And of course, Jesus used that principle as well. Or observed that principle as he washed the feet of his disciples. And he expressed in that his humility and his service, his humble service in coming to this earth. So there's a principle that's under consideration. The principle is hospitality. The practice was custom. It is a practice that we no longer observe because there is no longer the need for such an observance. While we can alter our practice as customs change, we are not, we do not have the liberty, we are not free to ignore or to refuse the principle that's under consideration. In other words, while we may no longer wash feet, we are still to be hospitable. And humility is a consideration. But the second thing that exactly what I give is the giving of the holy kiss, which was again a custom among Christians. We are given instructions to greet one another with a holy kiss. Now, what is the holy kiss? What's the significance of the holy kiss? It is a sign of fellowship, and it is a sign of fraternity. And it may be that it's still that custom in certain cultures, it certainly is, to actually plant a holy kiss upon one another. The practice in some cultures is air kisses, and some it may be a hug, some it may be a right hand shaking. There are different things that we do. Now, do we have the right to reject the principle of fraternity and fellowship and expressing such things to our brethren? No, we do not. But are we bound to the specific custom in the expression of that, in that it was a custom? And the point that one commentator that I was studying read this and said, you know, we acknowledge that, we recognize that in regard to practice, with regard to the holy kiss, the washing feet. But if you're talking about the clear statement that something is a custom, you don't get a more clear statement than the Apostle Paul makes in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 16, that this was a customary practice in the church in the first century. And so the point that I would make, what I would contend in this regard, is that we have a specific situation of a woman who was practicing an active practice of prophecy and prayer, in this particular case. And that if she were to do this, if she were to exercise a God-given right and authority, we'll deal with the assembly and silence in the assembly when we get into the 14th chapter. We're dealing here with regard to the symbol of authority, that she has to have that symbol of authority on her head. She has to express and acknowledge her understanding of her submissive place, and that principle cannot be ignored. But it is not the custom any longer for the wearing of the veil as it was in the first century. And it is not required for women who are in worship to wear that veil. So that's the, in a nutshell, the view that I hold with regard to that. And now I'll open it up to any comments, questions. Yes, Justin.
So I think you've about convinced me to change my understanding of this passage. I haven't expressed my understanding of the passage, so no one in class necessarily knows from whence I come or to where I go, but I have three things that I wanted to clarify. One, you're talking about not applying it to today. To the people he wrote it to, you're saying that it's definitely an additional covering, that long hair wouldn't suffice for the covering.
Yeah, I think that it is. Yes.
Two, we're talking about prophesying. We're talking about prophesying as being an exception to the silence, and you're given this gift, and so you wear this token of authority to do that, but also with prayer. So this would be a woman speaking aloud a prayer, but presumably also a prayer that was enjoined upon her as a spiritual gift, as a thing that she was being told to do through the Spirit. So there wouldn't be an application of that today, since we don't have spiritual gifts like that.
Yeah, and
since it's only active, there wouldn't be an application today, because you wouldn't wear the covering when someone else was praying, only when you were active.
And there are two problems with that view, or that. And understand this when I say problems. Whatever position you take in regard to this, there are arguments that can be raised in objection. This is one of those examples of a passage that is very, very difficult, which is why brethren have different views that they hold with regard to it. I'll just give you an example. The distributive and in that connecting prayer prophecy does not always, nor does it necessarily, indicate that the two of necessity are spiritual gifts. I think that they are. I do believe that to be the case, but there are others who argue that they are not, and that there's no way to establish the veracity of that contention. So again, in saying, well, how do you answer that? Yes, it is. No, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not. Yes, it is. I mean, it's just the view that you hold in that regard. It seems to be consistent with the context that would be the case. Secondly, it seems to some to make absolutely no sense why the Apostle Paul would say, okay, especially if we consider this being an assembly, in chapter 11, he's saying, okay, you people are doing this, you ladies are doing this in the assembly, make sure you've got a veil on. And then in chapter 14, he said, you people are doing this in the assembly, stop doing it in the assembly. Stop speaking in the assembly. Why wouldn't you just say it all at one time? Or why is it necessary to say, have the token of authority on your head when he's telling the women to keep silent in the assembly in chapter 14, verse 34, with regard to the exercise of spiritual gifts? I don't know. I don't know, other than the fact that he needed to teach them the lesson with regard to submission and this symbol. And then later on, when he begins to deal with the keeping silence, as he applies it both to men and or women and to men in certain circumstances, 1 Corinthians 14, that he deals with it, the woman's part, in a different area, different aspect of it. So, every position that you take, if you take the position, for example, that the woman's hair is a covering to her, so there's nothing artificial in the context, well, the actual Greek word that is used with regard to covering, it has reference to an actual article of clothing, not just her hair. And then you have, of course, individuals who will take the position that a woman must do that today, And from that, they deny the nature of it as being a custom in verse 16 or not following that. So there are different views that are held. We talked about that a little bit more last week, and it's difficult. It's a difficult passage, which is why I ask for understanding as we consider these things. But yes, that's the view that I would hold, that the prayer and prophecy would be both having reference to spirit-directed activity.
So a third is, what does it mean because of the angels?
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, I've looked at commentaries. I've studied. I really don't understand that text, that part of the text. As far as the text in verse 10, this reason the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. I think that it most probably has something to do with the relative hierarchy that exists. You remember Jesus was made a little lower than the angels, and then he was exalted to a position above the angels at his ascension and his exaltation. He was a little lower than the angels, or made a little lower than the angels when he came to this earth as a man. And so when you look at the hierarchy, you have God, then you have the created beings, the angels, then you have mankind. But how that ties in with regard to the symbol and the veil, I really don't care to speculate on that. I'm still working on it. It's just you'll have to bear with me with regard to that.
When I read the first chapter 11 and then verse 10 about the angels, I was thinking, I guess this will remain one of the mysteries of God. And then a thought came to me. I've seen something in the past that might have put some light onto this, and it's found in Revelation 10 and verse 1. And they use the same phrasing, on his head and on her head. It's the exact phrasing, exact word for word, and it's behind, it shows the angels wearing a rainbow on his head. So we might get some information, you know, a little bit on that.
Yeah. It is an interesting thing. I think that when you look at the context and what's under consideration here, and that is the idea of submission and relative headship that is indicated in verse 3. Head of every man is Christ, head of woman is man, head of Christ is God. Bringing the angels into it, it seems like it is an indication of hierarchy yet again. But I don't know how it fits in. It's a very obscure phrase that I'm just not willing to state anything dogmatically with regard to. Yes, thanks.
They do learn that. Far as we know, it might be another use of the word angelos. It may not have been referring to heavenly bodies, but they've been referring to other people. To address one thing, and Justin was touching on, was the fact that these women were no doubt exercising their gifts in public as well as in assembly, and that's the reason why it was important for them to wear the covering in public. The covering was assigned to other people, not to herself. Not to herself. So that someone who saw her would see the covering and understand the meaning of it in their custom, in their tradition. They didn't have to explain it, what it meant. They knew what it meant. We have a vestige of this very custom today in the covering of men. Someone, I think, said in class maybe last time. I don't remember. I think you use it as an example. Where someone talked about if a man came into the assembly and refused to remove his covering, he'd be asked to leave because it was showing dishonor. Most men I know, most brethren I know, won't pray in public with their head covered. or definitely in assembly, but just in public in general. But it's because it's assigned to other people. That doesn't mean that if you're undercover, you can't pray if no one knows you're praying, because it's not assigned to anybody. If you're a construction worker on the site and you have to wear protective gear, you can still pray to God. That doesn't mean you can't pray. If you're a soldier, you're under orders and you're wearing a head covering, you can still pray, but no one else knows you're praying between you and God. But if you're in assembly or even outside and you're leading a prayer, we today will uncover our heads. And it's a custom, tradition, but it's the exact same thing that's going on in this context, I think.
Yeah, I think that, you know, and we acknowledge that. It's interesting. I mentioned to several that we had an opportunity to go to a football game at the Cowboys Stadium in Arlington, high school football game. And before the game started, every individual was asked, all the men were asked to remove their hats before the playing the national anthem. And I think even maybe with regard to school songs, but certainly with regard to the national anthem. And we've always acknowledged that. It is something that is a part of the, you know, the, if you go to, you know, what they call them, the actual rules with regard to flag decorum that's found in the guidelines, that's a part of that. And we acknowledge and recognize it. I remember just a number of years ago, I've only been a half dozen years ago, at the Fuller College summer camp, that several of the young Christian ladies that had gone to that had come back, and they were a bit upset that during the singing and the prayers that were offered and everything, that the young men were wearing baseball caps. That was because they felt that it, again, was disrespectful to do that. You know, it's very common in our society now, it's becoming more popular with regard to style, to have those hats on. And it's something that I think we as Christians need to be aware of, especially in public, because it is considered by many to be disrespectful, and we certainly need to observe that and be respectful of those customs. So, you know, custom is has a big part to play with regard to these things. And someone said, well, it's only a custom, and I don't feel bound by it. Well, what you're doing, though, is you're offending individuals, and you are diminishing your influence, and it makes it more difficult for individuals to hear what you have to say because they see what you're doing. And to that extent, we need to be mindful of those things and be respectful of others in that regard. Yes, Jean?
It also, in some way, moves over into the area of modesty. If you were in a culture where every color was okay for you to wear except purple, and you decide you were going to wear purple every single day, that's drawing attention to you. That's going outside of what is customary and saying, I'm different, I'm special, the rules don't apply to me. And I think that then becomes an issue of immodesty.
It is an interesting thing that when you go back, you know, the brethren in the you know, centuries following the New Testament canon had trouble dealing with 1 Corinthians 11 as well, and what the Apostle Paul was teaching in that case. But when you see what they call the church fathers, the early writers writing on this particular subject, and they dealt with the veil and the covering, it almost invariably was addressed from that viewpoint, the modesty of the woman, and that a woman who was uncovered with regard to these things was not being modest in her expression. Of course, when we talk about modesty, and you look especially in the New Testament with regard to that teaching, it doesn't just have to do with revealing clothes or have to do with a lack of clothing. It also has to do with bringing attention to oneself and wearing things that are designed to emphasize superficially the external rather than the inner beauty of a gentle and peaceful spirit. So, modesty issues are to be considered as well in regard to this. Part of the customs of the day. All right. So that's the best I can do on it. Anybody have anything else in your hand? Yes, Dick?
I have a question here about the word, use of the word head, and there's two ways, maybe three here, but it's concerned about how it's using subjection in verse 2 of the head of every man is Christ. Verse 4, where it says, every man praying, prophesying, having his head covered, speaking of his physical body head. And according to Strong's Exoptic Concordance, is the same word is used in both cases there. So in verse 4, though, where it says, prophesying, having his head covered, just honors his head. Now, I assume that's speaking of a physical head, but it could be his head, which is Christ. So
My view in both verse 4 and 5 with regard to the word head in 5 with regard to the man, and the head in 5 with regard to the woman, that both of those are only referring to the physical head. That doesn't invalidate the principle that you're talking about with regard to, because we're talking about headship and submission, it's under consideration here. But because of the relative place that the man has, the relative place that the woman has, it would be inappropriate for the man to cover his head, inappropriate for the woman not to cover her head. Especially in verse 5, if you say, okay, every woman who prays and prophesies with her head physical uncovered dishonors her head, the man, for that is one and the same in shape as if her head, are we back to the physical head, or are we talking about the man being shaved, you know, in the situation? It's just within that context, it seems to me that the easiest understanding is simply to recognize we're talking about the physical head in both cases within that context of the call of submission and headship that's found in verse 3 and following.
That's the way I kind of took it.
Yeah. Yes, Justin.
So last week you talked about us not being the vanguards of cultural change, and the idea being, just to extend Gene's example, if some pop stars and whatever start wearing purple, and the vast majority of the culture thinks that they're behaving immodestly by doing so, then it would be inappropriate for us to start wearing purple. But, say, 50 years down the line, when 80-90% of the populace thinks it's okay to wear purple, then it would be okay for us to wear purple. Even though there might be some in our congregation that would be upset, not biblically offended, where they'd be tempted to violate their conscience, just upset by it. And I was thinking about throwing you under the bus. I think I will. The example I was going to use before Gene gave me purple was your beard.
Yeah.
Because when you start growing a beard, it upsets some people. But by and large, in the culture, it's okay to have a beard. And so it's an interesting dynamic where we end up lining up on that thing, you know.
Yeah, and I think some discernment is needed. Yeah, some discernment is needed. And I'll just use my beard as an example. Some ladies in this congregation still don't like my beard. And I'm thinking about shaving it off after I've had it now for about 3 years. But my wife and my mom like it. And my daughters like it, and so I kept it. But having said that, some expressed to me they really didn't like it. So, but having said that, I think that there is a distinction between that and then if it were to have caused some problems. I don't think that there was any diminishing of my influence as a result of it. It was an expression of personal dislike. Not of any concern with regard to my spiritual standing or my inability to lead others or anything like that in that regard. Or lack of respect, those kinds of things. So if that had been something that came to mind, most probably I would not have kept it in that regard for that very reason. But at the same time, having said that, sometimes people can be extremely unreasonable. And maybe there's some need for some teaching in that regard. But you don't have to just go. That was first bell, wasn't it? So I've got a minute or two. You don't have to just go to 50 years in the future, because we've got that understanding with different cultures today and Christians in other places, and we've actually dealt with that in the past. And I acknowledge it and recognize it, that we're living in a day and time where we are becoming a more casual people. And you can see that just from, you know, look at the movies in the 1950s and the way people dressed in the 1950s and what men wore to the office and what women wore in office. So the culture is changing. And it's something that an older generation needs to acknowledge and recognize, that more casual dress is not indicative of a lack of reverence or respect on the part of a younger culture. But at the same time, it just really, really bothers me to see young men going up in leading in worship with the shirt tails coming out. You know, you realize that, that young men think it's really cool to have a vest over a dress shirt and the shirt tail hanging out underneath the vest? That's the most goofy looking thing I've ever seen in my entire life. But that is cool these days. Yeah, that is slick. And that's, you know, considered, so it's not considered a lack of respect in regard to that. Well, maybe so. Maybe it'll reach that point or has reached that point. And so there needs to be on our part some recognition of those kinds of things. That, but at the same time, as Christians, we ought not to say, I don't care what people think of me. I'm going to dress the way I want to. Because that can be very disruptive as well. So discernment, love for one another, forbearance, patience, those things are needful. And when you have a situation where there is the beginning changes in culture, then we need to be, again, I think it's very important that we as Christians need to not try to press the point and not be at the cutting edge of those kinds of things because of the destructive potential of others.
Just a small point. The ladies in the congregation were judging among themselves. That's what they were doing. Marvy came to me the last time I tried to go over there and says, "You shake that." Marvy told me that. All the ladies told me that. And the reason why it is because my wife told me that. So that's why I had to come off. But I think a very important verse, a very important phrase in this whole discussion here in context is judge among yourselves. When he tells them to judge among themselves, he's saying, you use common sense and standard practice beyond what I'm telling you. What I'm telling you is all correct, but you just rely on that, and that will tell you that this is all there is.
We're not going to be discussing the Lord's Supper next, even though it's next in the context. We're going to deal with that under practical considerations, because I think the primary thing was they're abusing things, and we didn't know why. So we're going to be discussing spiritual gifts as the next section of our study. Appreciate very much everyone's kindness in this discussion. And we'll pick up the spiritual gifts next time.